to me. There we go. Pro Tools is sometimes very finicky. Okay, so you might have saw the email. I want to talk about something a little bit lighthearted, maybe, because things have been so stark raving serious lately. My good friend Hanuman, who you've probably heard me talk about before, used to always say this thing that I thought was so funny. He would say, life is way too important to take seriously. And I just love the way, that's such a Zen way to think about things. And so the question becomes, I don't know about you, but one of the most joyous things in my life, one of the things that I enjoy about other people and about life that actually brings me lots of ease and lots of joy is humor. A good sense of humor, a good laugh. I think it's almost like a direct doorway to gratitude. And at the same time, humor can be very harmful. It can be very destructive. And so one time a Dharma teacher asked me a couple years ago, they said, you know, is there anything that the Buddha missed? You know, he seems to have covered all the territories. Is there anything that you think is really important in life that the Buddha never really mentions? And if so, what is that? And for me, it was right off the bat, it was like, well, humor, a sense of humor, laughter, joyousness, connection. I mean, some of my closest friends and some of the people that I love to be around the most are people who just happen to be really funny. Right? It's such a great experience. I think it's such a metta practice. It's such a metta practice. It's such a gratitude practice. It's such a great way to connect with other people. And people who are like stark raving serious don't want to spend too much time with them, honestly. Always afraid I'm going to say something a little bit too. And let's just be honest, I'm capable of saying some things that probably could be left unsaid. And I always felt, you know, this is why I miss Against the Stream so much. And I miss that Dharma community so much, because there was so much room there for like a sense of humor and a lightheartedness where you don't get that at a Spirit Rock or an IMS. Or really, most Dharma places are pretty uptight, pretty serious. And so, you know, it's such a bummer that organization went the way that it did, because it was so much welcome there. And I also think that this is, you know, there's no mention of, there's actually no Dharma teaching that I can even point to, that even covers this territory, except for metta, which I'll talk more about that now. But, the one thing I can say is, if you start reading and if you take on the, tremendous difficult task of starting to look at the teachings in the Pali Canon, a very large amount of them, almost 70% of the teachings in the Pali Canon, are in dialogue. They're almost all dialogue. The Buddha's talking to somebody. Somebody sits down, they ask the Buddha a question, they have a dialogue, and that's kind of how most of it goes. Or he's having a dialogue with a monk, or a dialogue with Ananda, so on and so forth. And a lot of the exchanges, actually, if you really look at them, are really pretty funny. The Buddha's actually kind of a funny guy. Where like someone will ask him a bunch of questions and he won't answer them, and they'll get pissed off and kind of scurry off. Or somebody will ask him a serious question about karma and rebirth, and he'll just kind of dismiss what they're saying, and he'll just redefine them in a whole different way. He does do some stuff that actually I think is kind of funny. And then someone asked me this question, is like, do you think it would have been enjoyable to hang out with the Buddha? Like, if you actually got to go back and hang out with this guy, would he have been any fun? Or would he have just been like, you know, would he have been like a good hang? And it's like, I'm not really sure, actually. I think he might have been kind of a little bit of a dick, maybe. Like, he just was so, I don't know. And I think about this stuff sometimes, because I think it's important, because I think a lot of us, we can find there's really no gauge for how to move through this stuff. So if we talk about humor and seriousness, I guess is the two ways you could think about these in extremes. And they also point really, really to what my teacher Stephen Smith calls the cool warmth of metta, which you've probably heard me talk about this before, which I like. Is that there's a coolness and there's a warmth to about it. It's kind of like that perfect temperature. You know, it's like, I'm cool, but I'm still warm. I'm not cold. I'm not too hot. It's like that just right feeling in the emotion, in the mind, in the body. And we know this experience. And so humor points to the coolness of non-attachment. Now, for example, we've all had times in our life where people pick on us or make fun of us. And sometimes when people pick on me or make fun of me, I can kind of be lighthearted and laugh and go, yeah, you're right. I'm totally like that. Yeah, ha, ha, ha. Like, I can do that. I do this with my wife all the time. Sometimes people can make funny comments about us and we can be cool in that. And sometimes not at all. Sometimes we get offended. Sometimes we take it really, really seriously. Sometimes we get kind of, you know, we get all kinds of ways about that. So we have to understand that if we're going to participate in humor, that there's a degree of non-attachment. So the two things we have to watch out for is how attached we are to our sense of self. And if we feel like somebody's making fun with us or making fun of us, or they're just trying to be mean, and we can take it either way. So you're never going to get this practice right, but these are some things to think about. The other thing is how attached we can get just around views and opinions and around seriousness, around, oh, that's not funny. You shouldn't joke about that. And then we can have conflict there. So the other side of that is seriousness, which to me would be caring. So there's non-attachment and there's caring. The problem with these two terms is this is where they can kind of get us in trouble, is when the non-attachment becomes a little bit too cold, or a little bit too indifferent, or a little bit too schadenfreude, a little bit too enjoying watching the other person suffer a little bit. Which, I don't know if you remember the playground in elementary school, this is kind of what goes on the whole time. At least I've noticed. But the other side of that is the caring can actually become too much clinging. So, you know, the near enemy of compassion or caring is actually attachment. You know, and it's a classic kind of Al-Anon thing. It's like when we love the person so much, we care about them so much, we're so attached to a particular outcome, we get into controlling. And this happens too sometimes in a humor situation or just a social situation. If somebody makes a joke or says something about something that you think is important and get really, really reactive, but actually doesn't have anything to do with you. And there's no, other than just having a dialogue about this, which I think is important, there's really not much I can say in terms of what you should or shouldn't do, except for just kind of trying to take this on, as a practice, because, when non-attachment becomes cold, that's not great. And when caring becomes clinging, that's not great. And we lose that meta. We lose that friendliness. And I actually think that the reason why I think friendliness is the best term for meta, first of all, it's the most accurate term, and you probably know, have caught on by now, I'm pretty uptight about accuracy when it comes to this stuff. But that's why I have a lot of pushback against this term loving kindness. I have no problem with the word love, but it's a complicated word, let's be honest. And the idea that I could love everybody, there's no way I could even wrap my head around that. But I can definitely be kind to everybody. And I'm in these situations out here too, which where, especially because of where I live, and like even at like soccer games, when I coach Emmett's soccer team, it's like, sometimes people will talk or joke about things that are kind of not really that cool. And then I'm like, okay, do I make conflict here with this person, or do I just kind of be kind and friendly and like not get involved? Especially around politics and around current stuff that's going on in the culture, you know, the COVID hoax, you know, those kinds of things where I want to roll my eyes and give them a lecture, but it's like, well, what's that going to accomplish? Now I'm like getting in an argument and a fight with like Emmett's soccer friends, parents on the field. Like, that's not going to be good. You know, so what do you do? Like, what do we do in these complicated situations? And so this cool warmth of metta really helps me a lot of times, because I'm like, you know what? Like, there's certain situations where I just have to realize, like, I don't really have a dog in this fight, at least in this particular moment. There's, you know, first of all, I'm not going to convince this person that they're wrong, because that's usually what we're trying to do. But I also don't have to pretend like I think it's funny or I agree. So there's a couple things that I think that when we're kind of ending up here, I think, is looking at the teachings on right speech, which I know I even cringe slightly saying the word right speech, because it totally to me feels like, okay, here comes the rules, you know, right speech. And some of you might've heard a talk I did years and years ago, which is the way that I think about right speech, which is I translate it as authentic communication. And that means, how do I be authentic in my exchanges with other people? Which feels a lot more doable. And it actually feels a lot more like I'm interested in taking that on. Personally, I'm not interested in having the right speech, because I totally don't. You know, I just don't. At least by whose standards now? Like, whose standards, you know, is it even okay for me to say that? Because I would argue I very rarely will you catch me saying things to people that are mean or mean-spirited. Now, sometimes I say things that offend people, there was no intentionality to offend. But because I didn't intend to offend them, does that mean I'm off the hook? You see how complicated and how quickly this gets complicated? So when I think about authentic communication, there's kind of really four or five gates you can run this through, I think. And of course we know most of them, but the first reflection in this is what am I saying? Is it true? Is it useful? Is it kind? Is it timely? Are the classic Buddhist lists on time? But then I think I have to add some other ones. I have to add, is this authentic? Because sometimes I can say something that's true and useful and timely and kind, but it's not authentic. I'm just regurgitating some social nicety to make somebody feel better, or to try to appear a certain way. It's like, this doesn't feel authentic. This hits all four. This is like your classic Dharma teacher, right? They're hitting all four, but you know, you're like, I don't actually believe, or I don't actually feel that you actually mean what you're saying right now. So there's that authentic part of it. If you listen, there's a talk, I put a section up recently, Dharma Talks. There's not that many in there, but I've been wanting to add them for years. I just did it. Stephen Batchelor recently did a talk for Cambridge Insight back in November on a secular perspective on the Eightfold Path. He's always a little bit ahead of me, this guy. But he of course, you know, he takes a lot of freedom in translating these things. But he actually translates right speech as samavacha. Vacha is the Pali word. He actually argues that it doesn't mean speech, it means voice. So how do we find our voice? And to me, that really points to the idea of being authentic. In fact, when I met with him last year, which is the last time I left my house, really, back in March, we were talking about this, and he was asking me about how my teaching's going and what was I teaching and, you know, what was I getting? You know, we were having a lovely conversation about teaching. And he asked me, do you feel like you found your voice? And I was like, I love that question. I've never heard it before. I'm not exactly sure what you mean. But he said, no, that's part of right speech as teachers, is we have to find a voice, a language that we embody, that we use to speak, that's authentic to our experience. And then I said, well, that's interesting you say that, because when I teach right speech, I teach it as an authentic communication, which is really what it is. So I think when we start to look at being humorous or being serious, or how we approach other people and how we approach the world, is that what's actually most important, whether you're being honest and kind and timely and all that stuff, okay, that's good. Nothing wrong with that. But I think what we want to try to aspire more is to find our voice. You know, how do you say what you say? You know, so that way when you say it, people know that you're saying it because they know your voice. They're like, oh, that sounds like, what you just said sounds like you, right? Like, there's a lot of even comedians and stuff. There's a lot of people out there who are like, I love comedians. I love comedy. Like, YouTubing comedy shit over the last 8 months has basically gotten me through many days. And a lot of the comedy that I like and a lot of the comedians that I like often will say things that I think really aren't very cool. But they're saying them in their voice. And I'm like, that's, I don't like what you're saying and I don't agree with what you're saying, but you're saying it. You're not, and I don't get the sense that they're trying to offend or hurt anybody. And then we see, I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole on this one, but we see a lot of this stuff in our culture now around comedians getting in all kinds of trouble because they've said things that are not politically correct or not whatever. And so they're like, that's what our job is. Our job is to actually, to say what we're not, their job is to actually say things that you think that you really shouldn't say. So it's a really, I think it's a hot topic. I think nobody talks about this, unfortunately. But I think we can kind of, and then the other thing about this, and we'll do a practice on this, is when you talk to yourself in your own mind, which is also known as thinking, but to me, thinking is just me talking to me in my own mind. Is that right? It's not really thinking. It's just Dave talking to Dave about a wide range of topics. And how much humor do I have in a lightheartedness in what I would say, which is another reason I love the 12-step paradigm, is this tremendous emphasis on humility. You know, can I have a sense of humor about myself? And can I also have a sense of seriousness? Because I think a lot of people find, especially good Buddhists and also good white folks, is that we tend to get in this really kind of hyper serious about like having to do it right and having to get it right and just really being way, way too hard on ourselves about this practice. There's a term they use back in Boston in early AA when people are like in their first 6 months, they say, oh yeah, watch out for him. He's stark raving serious. Or sometimes they'll say stark raving sober, which means like 2 months ago, he was breaking into cars and peeing his pants. And now he's like, thinks he's like basically like this most righteous person who ever lived, right? There's that huge, and you people in recovery, you've seen these people. Maybe you've been that person. I was that person for a little while. It's not fun to be that person. It's not fun to be stark raving sober. But this is why I actually have, so the last thing I'll say that's very, very important in this conversation, I think, is what's known as Kalyanamitta, a good friend, spiritual friend, is I think that we have to have really good friends and really good people that we trust enough that we can speak to in our own voice and maybe get away with saying some stuff that we probably wouldn't or shouldn't say. You know the people you like to be around, right? You're like, when there's certain people when you're around them, you can pretty much say anything. And it's great because you don't have to do that. You don't have to add that filter. You don't have to add that serious filter or that say it right filter. You can just be you, you know? And maybe you'll say some things that are totally uncool and inappropriate, but in the parlance, or not in the parlance, but in the exchange with that person, you know each other so well that that's okay. For example, and I think it's really important that we have good friends and Kalyanamitta friends who don't care about your Dharma practice, who don't necessarily care about your recovery, who don't share the same necessarily, for lack of a better word, philosophical values as you do. Like, for example, I have 4 or 5 really, really good friends from my drinking days back in Boston. Like real, real hardcore Boston punk rock shithead kids, just like those kids. They're good people. They're funny. They're great. But they're like totally quick to make fun of me for being a Buddhist teacher. They never will ascribe to me being like an authority on anything. And so they really hold me to this bar of authenticity where like, I just actually have to be Dave. Like if I try to even come at them with any kind of wise thing, they'll just hammer me for it. They're like, oh yeah, here comes Dave with his poly cannon. And they'll just let me have it. And like, if I don't have those kinds of people in my life, I can get into big trouble. I can get kind of too serious. And then I actually get to have really very real conversations and very authentic conversations with them in a voice that's important to me that can actually really speak to what's going on without having to filter it through some kind of special Dharma filter or recovery filter or PC filter, whatever filter we have to filter these things through. So this is again another reason why I love being in recovery, is because these are the kind of conversations that happen before and after AA meetings. You know, and they're not always the most skillful conversations, but they do help people, you know? And so I think that we, when we, if we actually take this on, and also this is a great practice because you talk all the time. We're always talking all the time. And I try to notice, and one of the compliments that I get that I really appreciate is people say that when they talk to me one-on-one or they listen to a Dharma talk from me on a podcast, they don't feel like there's two different people talking. That I've gotten to the point where I feel like I'm at least getting close to having a voice. It's just like, when I talk, I just talk. I don't really change my, you know, if I go to a teacher meeting at Emmett School, I probably don't swear, but other than that, that's about it. So I try to, as they say, keep it real in that way. And it's really hard, but it's such a really beautiful practice because as far as watching my mind and watching our minds go, this is an area where you can get a lot of information. And because you talk so much, just having a little bit of mindfulness running in the background while you're talking to other people, what you're talking about, you learn so much about yourself, especially when we say things. And this is the thing that I always push back against. When we get stark raving Dharma serious and we can say what we're saying is true, it's useful, it's timely, and it's kind, and it's totally inauthentic. It's totally not something that we even mean or that we feel or that we would normally say. But now we want to get a gold star for being a good Buddhist because we're ascribing to this kind of filter. And a lot of times it doesn't even feel so good to have to do that. So I don't have trying to think about this for a while this morning when I was outside feeding my animals in the cold, trying to think of a practice to do around this. I think that what I came up with is actually trying to see this as a right effort practice. So in a meditative practice, trying to try to be during the practice, but not to make it too serious, but to not let it slip and not let the mind wander all over the place, and just trying to watch your coolness and your warmthness, not getting too hot, not getting too cold, not getting too clinging, not getting too wandering, just kind of how do we, you know, present time awareness-ish, as they say. And so we can do this here for a little bit and have some more conversation about the conversation. So you can find a comfortable way to sit if you like. Let's get into some practice mode. Probably do a little bit shorter of a sit today because I talk so much, sorry. And we'll start and end with the bell. So beginning here this morning by allowing our bodies to find an upright, suitable posture for practice. Bringing your mind and heart and your body into the present time experience here and now. And bringing your attention to the direct experience of breathing in and breathing out. Breathing in, sustaining the attention with the full length of the in-breath to integrate, to bring the mind and the body together, to open to any feeling or emotion that is also present. Breathing out. Letting go. And as we begin, just taking a minute or two to establish a present time mindful awareness. And then seeing if you can allow your mind and heart to open to this experience of metta, this cool warmth. So there's a coolness of not being too attached, being open, not trying too hard. The coolness of accepting things as they are. And then there's the warmth of having a kind, caring attitude towards yourself. So there's a presence. We can be present in a way that feels cool, easeful. And we can develop a caring that is also easeful and kind. This is accomplished often by just not putting too much pressure on yourself. And then bringing to mind this idea that thinking is just your internal voice. So seeing thoughts, thinking as we normally speak of them, as just your internal voice, the voice the voice of your mind, of your heart, of your soul, of your experience. And then doing this inquiry and trying to discover what would be the most authentic and meaningful message for that voice. To say. Would be things such as, I am okay just as I am. May I learn to be at ease in this world. May I learn to treat myself with kindness and friendliness. May I learn to do the best I can and allow that to be good enough. Or any of the phrases that you've used in heart practice work would all be relevant. And as you practice in this way, you can even ask and reflect on the question, what is it that you most want yourself to know? And if you are finding in this practice, you're coming into contact with some of the voices in your mind and heart that aren't so kind and aren't so helpful, see if you can offer forgiveness to those voices. for the last minute or so, just to reflect on what is it that you most want to say to yourself that you've been unable to say or to acknowledge. Because of fear. Or denial. Or feelings of not being good enough. And if nothing strong emerges, you can just allow yourself to just rest. To just be in this open field of awareness. Breathing body. Present time. Nowhere to go, nothing to do right now. Just practicing being in the stillness of your own mind and body.